Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Philip Lance, and I'm your host for today's episode, in which I'm interviewing Elliot Jurist about his book, Minding Emotions, Cultivating Mentalization in Psychotherapy, published by the Guilford Press in 2018. This interview may also end up on New Books in Psychology channel. And in today's interview, we'll be looking at this relationship between psychoanalysis and psychology, especially clinical psychology. Elliot Jurist is a professor of psychology and philosophy at the Graduate Center, the City University of New York, where he served as director of the clinical psychology doctoral program for many years. Dr. Jurist is the co-author with Peter Fonagy and others of a book called Affect Regulation, Mentalization, and the Development of the Self, which many of our listeners may know about that book. And he's also the editor of Psychoanalytic Psychology, the Journal of Division 39 of the American Psychological Association. So welcome to the program, Dr. Jurist.
Thank you very much.
And so a lot of our listeners probably are familiar with that book that you wrote with Peter Fonagy, Affect Regulation, Mentalization, and Development of the Self. It's a book I see so much cited in the literature, and it's on my list, on my Amazon wish list of, you know, eventually books I gotta buy and read because it's, I guess, a classic. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious about how this book, Minding Emotions, let's see, where's the title? Cultivating Mentalization in Psychotherapy. How is this book that we're talking about today? How does it follow on affect regulation, or what does it add to that field?
Yes, well, I think Minding Emotions grows directly from the affect regulation book. I had written the chapters on the history of affect and on mentalized affectivity, and the new book expounds and in some places I think corrects ideas from the earlier book. I'm interested especially in responding to people who imagine that mentalization is a kind of merely a cognitive concept. And that's why I pay a lot of attention to emotions. So you could think of the new book as mentalization theory, you know, 15 years down the road. I mentioned that it corrects ideas from the earlier book. Probably the biggest point in that connection is that we had suggested in the 2002 book that mentalization grows out of secure attachment. But research has shown that infants have earlier mentalizing skills, actually as young as 7 months old. So that point needs to be qualified. And one other point is that we had suggested that borderline personality disorder meant that someone was unable to mentalize. And that's also, I think, a little bit simplistic because it's more accurate to suggest that they lose the capacity to mentalize under certain conditions rather than just lack the capacity. So kind of a bottom line is that the relationship between attachment and mentalization is a lot more complicated than we had understood at the time.
Okay. That's fascinating. And we're in this whole realm of attachment and mentalization and borderline personality disorder. And at some point, we're going to get to some questions about where psychoanalysis fits into this. But let's begin sort of step by step. And maybe even from the very first, I think it was first sentences of the book, where you say, we often do not know what we feel. And that's so true. Although when I first read it, I thought, what? What do you mean we don't know what we feel? It really is. It's a simple idea, but taken for granted. And so you developed this idea by elaborating on a concept you call aporetic. Am I pronouncing it right? Aporetic emotions. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Sure. Well, I think it is often supposed wrongly that we always know what we feel, or we know what we feel in some automatic way. That happens to be one of the assumptions of the basic emotions paradigm in psychology. So I was looking to try to capture something that really is an everyday experience of people in therapy, and not necessarily in therapy, of knowing that they feel something but not being able to understand it, and having to put effort into that process. So the idea of aporetic emotions, which is derived from the term that refers to Socrates' dialogues, in which in some ways he's trying to become clearer about the questions rather than to be able to provide answers, that it is possible to make progress in understanding your emotions, but sometimes that is difficult, and it takes effort. So that's what I was hoping to capture.
Yeah, I have a good example of that just because I met with a client recently who's kind of obsessed with buying a new luxury car. And I recently spent an entire, but he's distressingly obsessed. It's like taken over his life. And so we spent a lot of time unpacking all the different kind of feelings that were underneath, underneath that. So, I think as, you know, and I'm a psychoanalytic psychotherapist, but I can see how a lot of the work I do sometimes is beginning with this basic level of helping people begin to understand and think about their feelings. So say more now about once we help a patient begin to identify what they're feeling. You talk about a number of different kind of steps: identifying, modulating, expressing emotions. Can you say more about, and you go into
sure.
each?
Well, I think I had an intuition that identifying, modulating, and expressing emotions were distinct and to some degree separate aspects of experiencing emotions. And also that this could help give us some insight into where patients were assessing patients' skills, strengths, and weaknesses. And it turns out that my research team actually has demonstrated the robustness of these distinctions. So the intuition that these are three different components of experiencing emotions turns out to be strengthened.
So we're talking to somebody from with a psychoanalytic background who's talking about assessments.
Right.
Which probably you don't hear that much on this channel.
There's a long history of psychoanalytic involvement in assessment. I mean, it's true that like the Rorschach is very controversial, but in the clinical psychology doctoral program that I teach in, we're very committed to training students to do assessment in a psychodynamically sensitive way.
And I think later in the interview, I want to come back to that relationship between clinical psychology doctoral programs and psychoanalysis. But so have you created some assessments to measure aspects of emotional, I don't know. Can you say about that?
Yes. So this, the measure is called the Mentalized Affectivity Scale. It's still in a fairly early stage of being developed. We're just beginning to use it on a clinical population. One of the most intriguing findings so far, which is actually kind of complicated to unpack, is that people who have disorders are actually better at identifying emotions than control cases, but they're worse at modulating their emotions. So that provides some support for the centrality of working with modulating emotions in therapy.
Okay, so let's stay with this modulating emotions, because that sounds similar to what I often hear probably is called emotional regulation, helping patients regulate. Is there a difference between modulating and regulating emotions?
I think so. I mean, that's one of the central points that I try to make, that the language of regulation implies a kind of top-down control of cognition exercise over the emotion. And modulation, which is a term that, in music has to do with sort of the blending of different things or blending of sounds. So I prefer the idea of some kind of integration of affect and cognition, not that the cognition subdues the emotion.
Oh, that's really interesting. And I like this. So this links to another question I have about this top-down idea.
Yeah.
I really like how my doctoral dissertation used a critical psychology approach, which I haven't worked a whole lot with since then, but I did learn about how so many of our psychological ideas and psychoanalytic ideas are really colored by ideological biases that have to do with power relations. And you have you keep that in mind throughout this book, and even have a little critique of this idea of emotion regulation, regulating emotions as being. Kind of, say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to recognize and theorize about how culture impacts on emotions, and that we need to be a little more cautious about terms like emotion regulation or emotional intelligence is another big concept these days, because I do fear that the way they're often used, intentionally or not, is to reward people who are already privileged, and also a way to misconstrue people who are not. Let me try to give you an example. James Baldwin famously talked about the importance of sustaining rage as a response to white racism. Now, do you understand that as a failure of emotion regulation, or can you be open to the idea that's an appropriate kind of regulation of the motion of anger upward, given the reality and the continuing reality of racism in our society? The other point that I make about these terms is that I do think they reflect a kind of bias of neoliberalism, in which there's this heightened value placed around the idea of containing or restricting your body to not interfere with others.
Wait, so say a little more about that. That one caught me off guard. So,
okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, your question was about how bias can enter our field, how it can influence the direction of research. And it's always interesting, you know, to look at what point in time certain ideas gain prevalence. And what I'm suggesting is the idea of emotion regulation and emotional intelligence corresponds to a period of time in which, you know, I think there's a lot of support for the idea of people being sort of responsible for themselves, as opposed to what I could maybe characterize in terms of like a more communitarian kind of thinking.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay, I see how. If our role as clinicians is just to help our or try to like push our clients to be more adaptable to society and get along, that's sort of, we're just sustaining a status quo when maybe we need to be helping our clients, some of our clients become less emotionally regulated and get out there into the streets.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I actually say that I don't think we should just presume that it's always better to regulate your emotions, right? I mean, there have to be some spheres in which emotional outpouring seems like it's appropriate. The other point that I think is contained in what I'm saying about emotion regulation is that it's more relational than just this idea of an individual taking care of him or herself.
Okay, so I'm beginning to see, or maybe our listeners are too, how we're talking a lot about emotions, and this is, I guess, a subset of the broader topic of mentalization. So as part of mentalization, like you said in the beginning, it's not just a cognitive process. It includes how we handle our emotional life as a part of mentalizing. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you could understand, you know, mentalizing as distinct from reasoning because it builds in an emotional component in the process.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And, you know, maybe I can just say a word or two about just the history of the term mentalization, because one of my chapters deals with that fairly extensively. But the word was used by French psychoanalysts who were interested in psychosomatics. And their understanding of mentalization really is about reading bodily states. So it's very far away from the other connotation of mentalization that comes from theory of mind, in which it's a little more abstract and it's about reading other people's mental states. And I think the originality of mentalization theory within psychoanalysis is to find a way to demonstrate that mentalization has to do with reading one's own states and reading the mental states of others, and that it entails some integration of cognition and affect.
Okay. All right. I see how now we're beginning to move into the area of psychoanalysis, not only because you mentioned the French somaticians.
Psychosomaticians.
So, because we're beginning to get into the area of things that aren't known cognitively, things that may be experienced in the body, which is what the French were trying to get at, and how we begin to represent or bring that into language.
Yes.
I probably a lot of people are going to say, well, mentalization is really mostly about dealing with consciousness and cognition. How can you make a case that mentalization belongs in psychoanalysis? Or
sure. I think there are different ways to address that, because first of all, there's no reason to assume that we are always aware of our mentalizing. There's often a distinction that's made between a kind of low-level automatic kind of mentalizing that's taking place all the time, right? And then a kind of high or kind of more subject to voluntary control, in which we sort of make the choice to specifically mentalize about something, right? So let's say in the face of an ambiguous social situation, someone does something and you try to explain to yourself what's going on with that, right? But that's different from that you're always taking in information that you might not need to be aware of. Now, it is true that that kind of idea of the unconscious as something which is, you know, out of mind unless it needs to be brought to attention is a little different from the sort of deeper psychoanalytic understanding of the unconscious. And here what I would say, and I'm not sure that others in the mentalization world would agree, but I think that we often begin to mentalize sort of retrospectively, right? So some people think of mentalization as, you know, you're confused or you want to figure something out. And so it's prospective. It helps you decide what you believe or what you are going to do. But I think that sort of distorts the fact that, you know, and again, this maybe comes back to operatic emotions that, you know, are the motivation for our actions is often not apparent to us. And that's where I think I remain committed to a more psychoanalytic understanding of the unconscious. So to put it in a way that might even sound a little perverse, you know, I think that we often begin to mentalize when we see that we should have mentalized, but we weren't able to do that.
I'm thinking about, as clinicians, when we're sitting with a patient who's speaking to us, a lot of what we're doing is would be mentalizing, and including, I guess, if we're having feelings about what the patient is saying to us, we're trying to mentalize our affectivity. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I do think, I mean, John Allen, who is a psychologist who was at Menninger's for a long time, likes to talk about mentalization as plain old therapy, right? So it's not something that is, in, you know, exactly news that therapists engage in a process of trying to mentalize the experience that patients are telling them, right? I don't entirely agree with that because I think that mentalization does require someone to be willing to have access to how their own history is influencing their mental states, right? So that's partially how the idea of mentalized affectivity is different from emotion regulation, in which you're just responding almost in an online way to someone else, right? Mentalized affectivity means that you're able to understand how your personal history or your autobiographical memory is going to have an impact on how you respond.
Okay. So as I'm continuing to sort of struggle with the line between psychoanalysis and mentalization, I'm thinking, let's say somebody who's been, all their training has been in mentalization theory. They've read all the books on mentalization, including yours. But they've never read psychoanalysis or been trained at a psychoanalytic institute.
Right.
Could they pretty much do the same work, though? I mean, as a psychoanalyst?
I would say yes and no. You know, first of all, mentalization theory has been put forth in the form of an evidence-based treatment approach by Peter Funicke called MBT, mentalized-based therapy. And that is different as a treatment approach than psychoanalysis. It's time-limited. It involves both individual and group work. And I think it has demonstrated success, especially with patients who have severe personality disorder. So that's appropriate for a different kind of patient than one who is likely to come to see you in private practice. I would recognize that mentalized-based therapy really is a different animal than psychoanalysis. And the qualification, I would make, though, is that, and this is something I do try to address in the book, that therapists and psychodynamic therapists and other kinds of therapists as well can adopt mentalizing strategies rather than seeking to adhere to an evidence-based kind of approach. But you know, the other point, since you sort of brought up, you know, what someone would be like as a therapist just being trained in mentalization, you know, it's very important to appreciate how mentalization, I think, is a part of the history of psychoanalysis and grows out. It has a large debt to Bionian ideas. Bion was one of the first psychoanalysts to really focus on the idea of thinking, and especially how some people really, you know, take flight from being able to engage in thinking. So both Bion, Winnicott, that kind of object relations context has been very formative on ideas that are part of mentalization.
Yeah, and let's get back to that because you have a chapter on contemporary psychoanalysis and, and mentalization. But, you know, I looked, as I was thinking about some of these questions, I looked in the index of your book to see if the word transference was in the index, and it's not. But
That's surprising. I think I do address transference. And yeah, that's, again, in a very time-limited therapy, that is not going to be the same phenomena as one in which, you know, transference takes time to be able to emerge. But, you know, MBT therapists certainly welcome patients to put into thought their reactions to the therapist. And, you know, the other form of evidence-based psychodynamic thinking is transference-focused therapy by Otto Kernberg and his group. And that certainly makes transference very central to the process.
Yeah, well, I was sitting here waiting for you to come online. I was looking at my bookshelf straight ahead of me, and I was looking at Severe Personality Disorders by Kernberg and thinking, I should pull that off and see what that's all about. It's been a long time. But,
right.
So let's see. One of the interesting things you do in your book is you bring in some personal sort of memoirs of a number of different people like Sarah Silverman and Ingmar Bergman. Yeah. What was your strategy with that?
Yeah, well, you know, it has to do with, I think, some ambivalence about talking too much about my patients. So it's some, you know, urge to respect confidentiality. I do have a number of clinical vignettes and try my best to disguise the identity of the patients. But I think the motivation in turning to some of these memoirs by Sarah Silverman, Tracy Smith, Ingmar Bergman, and Oliver Sacks was that I thought it would be fruitful to be able to look at how emotions are understood in light of autobiographical memory and narrative. And so choosing kind of complex, highly creative individuals became a sort of a focus of mine. I got especially interested, and there's almost an entire chapter is about the two autobiographies that Oliver Sacks wrote, which is sort of fascinating to look at because they're radically different. And Oliver Sacks, as you might know, was in psychoanalysis for, I think, 45 years with the same analyst. And it certainly seems that something about his experience of being in analysis for that long unleashed this amazing and extraordinary creativity, in which, you know, he invented a genre of writing, and really, you know, found his way. And that's a stark contrast to his description of his early life.
Yeah. That's another one of his books is another one on my Amazon wish list that I've got to get to that someday. But it's interesting, about 45 years, I had no idea. I wonder if he makes any case that it was the psychoanalysis that made the difference, because some people would say, after 45 years, things are going to change and develop.
Right. Yeah, it's a tough question, right? I mean, you know, in some ways you could say a measure of a successful analysis is that it ends. I mean, that, you know, termination is faced up to both by the patient and the analyst. In another way, you know, where's that idea coming from? If this is a crucial relationship in someone's life, and if someone continues to benefit from it, you know, I'm not sure that I kind of would agree that, you know, it must come to a conclusion. So, you know, Sachs was someone who I think came out of his early life experiences. He was sent out of London because of the bombing and was bullied. And also was really sort of rejected by his mother when it came out that he was gay. And the story was that he divulged that to his father and told his father not to tell his mother. The father told the mother, and the mother says something like, you know, she wishes he wasn't born. But what's really amazing about Sachs is that you know, he comes to terms with ways in which his mother was and remains an important person in his life, but also sees how that was incredibly damaging to him.
Okay. Well, you've just helped me solve the problem of what to add to my summer reading list, because I keep telling myself, I've got to stop just reading psychoanalysis. I really want something more. So that would be a good one. You have a chapter near the end about contemporary psychoanalysis, and you, what do you do in that chapter?
You know, I think that's my effort to not just describe mentalization and to tout mentalization as, you know, a new treatment approach, but to acknowledge its roots and its connections to other psychoanalytic sources. I guess the way I see mentalization theory is that it sort of shares a perspective with some relational thinking, some contemporary Bionian thinking, some elements of field theory, in seeing the process as being collaborative, and that it's less about content, in fact, than it is about process. I think that especially you hear it said that, you know, psychoanalysis is really about the relationship that exists between the patient and the analyst, and that, you know, research has supported the idea that it's the quality of the research, that the quality of the relationship that is most critical. And I guess in my book, I wanted to sort of take that point of view and to try to say a little more. And the idea that I end up centering on is truthfulness. I'm sort of wary of the idea of imagining that, you know, at the end of an analysis, it means that the patient has some absolute truth about him or herself, especially, you know, that sort of transparent or stable. But that part of what ought to happen is that one is committed to aspiring to seek the truth. In my preface, sort of acknowledge post the election of Trump, which has become certainly more true and more dangerous, that, we see a lot of disregard for the truth in our everyday lives.
Yeah, I have to say, I really like that preface. When I first was opening the book, I was thinking, well, I'm not sure this is going to be that much about psychoanalysis. But in any case, you had me hooked with the preface. I really appreciate.
I see. Well, the publisher was a little wary because, you know, it's true that it can become dated when you're responding at a certain moment in time. But somehow I just felt that I couldn't fail to acknowledge the massive change that has occurred with the election of Trump.
Yeah, well, I hope it is dated someday and in one sense. But I liked just the passion and the sort of fierceness of, and I thought, oh, this is somebody who's not afraid to, you know, like lay out his cards on the table. So,
Well, I hope that's where, you know, some emotional expressiveness, right? Not just sort of controlling and containing the emotions is revealed.
So you mentioned the quality of the relationship, and I think you said something about the scientific ways of sort of measuring that. So you ran a clinical psychology program for many years at City University of New York. Was it a psychoanalytic clinical psychology program did you have any trouble with your colleagues, bringing psychoanalysis into clinical psychology, which some people would say
I had the luxury of mostly having, and still do have, lots of colleagues who, are psychoanalytic, also colleagues who, if they're not, have been exposed to appreciate the value of that perspective. It's certainly not true in the larger world of clinical psychology. When I was the director, I actually spent a year trying to press the APA to reveal information about the way in which the various programs identify themselves. And the chosen identity that my program had was as a scholar practitioner program, and I can say a little more about what that means. But there were really five of those programs out of 172 across the country. So the predominant paradigm is a scientist practitioner one, where one will receive training to become comfortable with doing research, but at the same time to value the process of being trained as a clinician. The newer model that is now being embraced within clinical psychology is the clinical scientist model. And there, the idea is that any clinical training should be based upon research findings. And what I think is problematic about that is that, the quality of the research is not yet good enough to do that. In the program that I teach in, the centerpiece of the experience for students is clinical work. And we, teach students that clinical work is not easy, and that it takes a long time to be able to do it well.
And so if under this clinical scientist model, the training and education is supposed to be centered on, you didn't say the word evidence-based treatments, but
right.
then do you include, would you say that we need to do more research as psychoanalysts to make the case?
Although, I kind of have a complicated perspective on that point. On the one hand, it's true. I think that in order to survive, people who are invested in the psychoanalytic paradigm need to try to do research. And research is the path in which your voice can be heard. On the other hand, you know, it's a question of how you understand the meaning and value of research, and whether you see, you know, science as the only voice that counts. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's where my perspective is broader in appreciating different kinds of methodological approaches. You mentioned critical psychology, for example, mm-hmm. Which are really valuable as a part of a clinical education. You know, we've always had students in my program who have been English majors. You know, why would being an English major be a good background for a clinical psychologist? Well, you know, if you're someone who has been trained to pay close attention to narrative and to understanding complexity when it comes to character, that's a very appropriate background for someone who is becoming a clinical psychologist. So I value, I mean, the in the conclusion or the epilogue of my book, I have one piece of it that's titled Science, But Not Just Science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's experimental science, sort of what typically mm-hmm. we think of in sort of the Western world as that's science, but I guess there's other ways of thinking about science in a that come from more of a humanities sort of basis. Mm-hmm. So you're the editor of, a book series, Psychoanalysis and Psychological Science.
Yeah. In fact, let me make a correction because I was the editor of Psychoanalytic Psychology, the official journal of Division 39 of the APA for 10 years. But I stepped down as of January 1st. And now Chris Christian is the current editor. But there's a book series that Guilford Publications is doing called Psychoanalysis and Psychological Science that I am editing, and we have two other books that are going to be coming out in that series. One is from the TFP group associated with Otto Kernberg that focuses on treatment approaches for narcissistic patients. So it's, you know, based upon an evidence-based model, but it's directed to everyday clinicians to be able to adopt some of those strategies in their work with narcissistic patients. And then the other book that is coming out is by Joel Weinberger and a colleague, Valentina Stolveda. That book focuses on comparing ideas of the unconscious that come from psychoanalysis, but social psychology and neuroscience as well.
Whoa. Uh-huh.
So, you know, I guess, you know, my kind of preferred perspective is that psychoanalysis needs to open itself up to influence from other perspectives, and that is a kind of necessary thing going forward.
Yeah. So many people argue for why psychoanalysis needs to maintain a strong interdisciplinary sort of stance.
Mm-hmm.
But I think often when people say that, they're talking about the disciplines they're talking about are maybe anthropology or linguistics or maybe sociology, but why not other sciences as well?
Sure, sure. You know, I think the point is that there is a history of psychoanalytic institutes being more concerned with kind of perpetuating a point of view that is uninfluenced by outside thinking. And I think that actually has been harmful to the development of psychoanalysis. Uh-huh.
Well, you mentioned two books that are coming out in this series. The first one, I'd be really interested. I'll look for that one because I've read some of Kernberg's, what is it? TF, transference focused therapy. Yeah, uh-huh. Transference focused therapy. And I'm curious about what they're adding. They've have some sort of even like manuals of how to do transference focused therapy, but I'm curious about what new they're bringing to this new.
Yeah. Well, one of the most interesting findings of the research about TFP is that what changes when patients get better is that they become better mentalizers. Mm-hmm.
Well, and then what about you? Any new books you're working on?
I have a couple of different ideas in mind. Part of it is just to continue to do research and to learn about mentalized affectivity, that I want to sort of exemplify the idea of this is a beginning stage, and that the value of research is that it's fallible and that it has to evolve over time. So that's one of the things that I will be focusing on.
Well, great. I think that's it. So thank you so much, Elliot, for sharing us this time with us to tell us about your book.
Okay, it's been a pleasure talking, Philip.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Elliot Jurist about his book, Minding Emotions, Cultivating Mentalization in Psychotherapy, here at the New Books in Psychoanalysis channel. Check out our website and feel free to email me with your comments and questions. Thanks for listening.